So thank you all for coming today morning, and I'm sorry we got a little late. We had another, it was just a breakfast engagement, but we came a class over there, so that took almost 45 minutes. And I was in Sharjah yesterday evening and today morning, and so while in Sharjah, for most Indians, they hear about Sharjah primarily associated with cricket. So yesterday and today morning, I spoke on the theme of what cricket can teach us about life. So I'll continue that theme, and I'll speak about how cricketers, I was asked to speak on the topic of, you know, how to help our children grow properly. So I'll talk about that from the cricket metaphor of how a coach grooms talent in cricket. And similarly, how we can help our wards, our children, to also grow. Now, cricket is a very popular sport in India, and it is not even known in other parts of the world. America, till recently, if people were asked about cricket, they would think about the insect named cricket. They had no idea. So, yet, on one side, the specific sports may not be very popular, but the idea of sports is universal. In America, what people love is baseball, which is similar to sports. Now, in all sports, essentially, there is basic talent that is required. Some batsmen are just phenomenal, the range of shots they can hit. Or some bowlers are brilliant, how they can make the ball turn, how they can deliver the ball so precisely, whether it's spin bowler or fast bowler. They also have extraordinary talents. And yet, if you look at the history of cricket, there are many talented players who actually didn't do all that well. And there are some other players who may have had medium talents, but they did very well, relatively speaking. So, you know, talent is important in life, but talent is not all that is important. Many times in our life, we compare ourselves with others. And we compare, if we are parents, we compare our children with other children. Or we may compare, you know, one child with another child, if we have several children. So, at one level, comparison is just natural. We live in a competitive society, and we all have to achieve some things in life. You know, we may want to, say, get a slot in an engineering college or a medical seat, and there are a limited number of seats for that. So, competition itself is unavoidable in life. But our focus cannot be only on the competition. When athletes run, athletes, when they are practicing, it's not that different athletes are all together trying to practice. Athletes, their primary focus is not competing against each other. Their primary focus is competing against the clock. If there's a 100-meter sprint, now yesterday I did that in 15 seconds or whatever time it is. And now, today I'll do it in maybe half a second less. So basically, if there is comparison to be done, the most healthy comparison is to do the comparison with oneself. Now, what I was and what I am. So comparing ourselves with ourselves helps us to see on what track we are. Based on the talents that we have, some people may just be phenomenally talented. And if a person who is not talented starts comparing oneself with a person who is very talented, that person will always feel inferior. Some bowlers, they can just swing the ball anyway. They have an amazing array of kind of balls that they can bowl. There's some spin bowlers, they may just be genius. And some other spin bowler, that bowler may not have that much talent, but that bowler has discipline, that bowler has consistency. No? let's bowl the controlled line and length. So now, if this bowler starts comparing with some other bowler who can bowl very well in various ways, this bowler will feel inferior. But that bowler says, okay, this is what I can do. Let me do this well. So actually, talent is important, but along with talent, you know, if we want success in life, there are three things. There is talent, and then there is temperament. So talent and temperament together lead to achievement. So now, our basic level of talent can't be changed. We can hone our talents. Hone means we can improve by practice, by training, by exposure. But basic level of talent can't be changed. Somebody who has a certain level of musical efficiency, they cannot become like, say, Mozart or some other musical genius. But from where they are, they can improve. So quite often in today's world, especially because we live in a very interconnected world, so we can see people from this part of the world and that part of the world. So if we watch movies, we may see the kind of luxuries, say, people have in America or people have in other very prosperous countries. And it has been found in human psychology that most people get their sense of self-worth by comparing themselves with others. So if I'm in a group, and if I find, okay, you know, I'm among the better people in this group. You know, if it's financial group, yeah, I earn more than others. Then people feel, yeah, I'm someone special. If they are in a group where everyone is earning more than them, then they feel insecure. They feel inferior. Now, what our society does today, our culture does is, it actually often showcases the best in everything. So, if it's looks on the movies, in the ads, we may see the people who are the best in it, who look good, very attractive. And then, what happens after that? When we look at ourselves, we may feel, hey, you know, I don't look that good, or whatever. You know, once I was in a college, and there, my boy had written on his t-shirt. It was a typical mundane joke. Some of the people put a provocative statement. He says, 90% of the world's women are beautiful. The remaining 10% are in my college. So what he meant is that actually, how does he know what 90% of the women in the world are? He doesn't know. But he's getting that idea based on comparing with whatever he's seeing in the movies, in the media. And then he says, hey, you know, in real life, people are not that good looking. So that is very gross. But the point is that if we start comparing ourselves or our children or whatever with the ideal that are depicted in the media, in the movies, then we actually feel inferior, or we create feelings of inferiority in others. That's why it's important to accept people for what they are. We can't make people into we can't shape people according to our desires. People are what they are. They can be definitely shaped, but they cannot be shaped into something which they are not. So, if, you know, coach thinks, you know, I want to make this player into a bowler. But that coach is a bat, that player is primarily a batsman. That player can be a good batsman. He says, no, you bowl. But I want to bat. He tries to bowl and can't bowl so well. And he says, you are not sincere. You work harder. Well, if the player is a batsman, they can improve to some extent as a bowler. But their real strength is as a batsman. So it is important for a good coach. Now, coaches also sometimes have requirements. In this team, we need so-and-so player. But they cannot change, they cannot make a tail-ender bowler into an opening batsman. Tail-ender bowler can also bat sometimes. But so basic point is that many times we may try to force our children into a mold that they don't belong to. And that's not what they're meant to be. Krishna talks in the Bhagavad Gita about Chaturvaranyam Maya Srishtam Guna Karma Vibhagashah. He says there are basically four kinds of people. Now the point of that is not just to divide people. It's not that, okay, is my child a Brahmana or a Kshatriya or what? That may be difficult for us to discern. But the point, see, every system of classification, there are specifics and there are universals. But the specifics are these four divisions. But the universal principle is that different people are differently endowed. And when they are differently endowed, they need to be engaged accordingly. So, if a person is an intellectual and we tell them to do physical work, they just don't have the body, they don't have the mind, they just get drained out completely. On the other hand, somebody is suited for doing physical work. And you tell them, somebody has got a big build and they do a lot of physical work. Tell them, you know, study books for 8 hours every day. They'll just not be able to do it. So, much as we may desire people to, by people I refer to our children, our wards, whoever they are, though, to be in a particular way, we have to recognize that they are who they are. And we can only, after accepting them for who they are, we can help them to improve. But if we have too much of a desire, what happens with parents is that they want to project themselves into their children. That, you know, I wanted to become something, but I was not able to do that. You become like that. So once there was a court case between a husband and a wife. His husband said, I want my son to become an engineer. Wife said, no, I want my son to become a doctor. And they went to the court. A judge said, you know, why do you have to have such a big fight over this? You know, ask your son. What does he want to become? He said, no, we can't ask him. Why not? He's not yet born. So, sometimes we just project our desires on others so much, they're not even born in fighting. What should they become? So, actually, everyone is an individual. So, the expertise of a coach, whenever they talk about coach, coach discovers a new talent. The coach never creates a new talent. The coaches, if there are coaches, they're only watching. Okay, they may go to some local state level. If there's a national coach, he may go to the local state level playing championships or cricket tournaments and see, okay, who plays well. Hey, this is a good person. They may go to even district level or they hear someone. But what they do, they're spotting new talent. We can't create new talent. The talent exists, we spot it, we discover it. So parenting is more of the nature of discovery. It is not of the nature of creation. See, even when a husband and wife united, they create a child. We know that they are not really creating the person. They are giving body to a soul. So the person is already there and a particular soul comes into a particular body at a particular time. So normally speaking, because the body has come from the parents, that's why the children usually have some similarity with their parents. Now, maybe their eyes, their nose, their complexion or whatever. But there are also, there are also cases where sometimes some children have some talents which is just not there in the parents. So, for example, I was talking about the musical genius Mozart. Now, whether it will break his father, his grandfather, his great-grandfather, nobody in that generation was as musically, anywhere near as musically endowed as he was. So what does this mean? It's not just come by their genes. It's not just come from the parents. So who we are, that is actually the body we get from our parents. And that upbringing of the parents also shapes us. But the child is a soul on its own. And sometimes the child may develop or manifest characteristics which are quite different from the parents. So when we want to help our children grow, it is if we try to project our desires on them. This is what I wanted to do and this is what you should do. Sometimes the children may be able to do it, sometimes they may not be able to do it. So we have to see that whether our desire for them is matching with their talents. If our desires with for them and their talents are not matching. Basically, the expertise of Varnashram was what? That's okay. In Varnashram, the idea is that everybody has to face problems in life. Sometimes people say, you should think positive. Don't think of problems as problems. Think of them as challenges. Think of problems positively as challenges. That's good advice. But at the same time, you know, we can only think of certain problems as challenges. And other problems we will simply see as burdens. So for example, if somebody is of Brahminical intelligence, and then we tell them, you know, in the Bhagavatam, there is a verse which says that actually, if you give charity to a devotee, that charity is returned manifold. Can you find that verse? Now, say somebody is of a Vaishya mentality. We tell them, find this. See, you know, in the Bhagavatam, thousands of verses, Baba. Who will find one verse? To give a class, give the class without the verse. Who's going to notice? For that person, try to find a verse, it's like a big burden. Big burden. And suppose it's a Brahminical person. He says, yeah, come on, you know, I'll find a verse. Eagerly search it and find this one. This is a good one. This is also a nice verse. This was not so good. They'll eagerly do that. So for them, because that is their interest, that is their talent, so they can see that problem as a challenge. On the other hand, somebody else, say somebody with a Vaishya mentality. And then we tell them, you know, we want to build a nice temple, so we have to raise funds now. Say, yeah, now we have something to do, you know. Something, some challenge is there, some exciting is there. Something exciting is there. But then, if we tell that same thing to a person with a Brahmana, the Brahmana says, after you build a temple, what are you going to do? Ultimately, do you kirtan, you have to do katha. We'll do it now. Why do you have to spend so much money, do so much effort? Just chant Hare Krishna and be happy. So what has happened? For a person who is intellectual, building a temple may seem just like a big burden. So the point I am making is that what problem we'll face, we'll perceive as a challenge, and what problem we'll perceive as a burden, that is not the same for everyone. Depending on one's interests, depending on one's talents, we will be able to pursue some problems as challenges and others will remain as burdens. Now, life requires us to be flexible. That means, sometimes in life, we have to do the things which we may not like to do. Sometimes there are burdens which we have to bear. But, you know, we can bear burdens in life. But we can't bear life as a burden. That means, if throughout our life, we have to do everything which we don't like to do. Now, if my very job is something which not only I don't like, I hate, then I just cannot survive over there. People get psychologically damaged by that. So, certainly life requires us to make adjustments. We can never do the things that we like to do all the time. But if you have to do always the things which you don't like to do, they'll be miserable. And the whole principle of Varnashram was to overall engage people according to their natural interests. So same way, now we cannot have it's quite difficult today to have the Varnashram division of society, but we can look at our children and see that, okay, what are their talents, what are their interests, and help them to grow. Now everybody has to compete in today's world, and for that everybody requires a certain level of performance in certain spheres. But that should not be the sole barometer of the caliber of the child. If you can't get marks in your exam, then you are useless. That should never be there. Or worse, you know, then their son gets so much marks and you, why don't you get marks? That is very, very damaging, that kind of comparison. Comparison is unavoidable. It will actually be there. But when we consciously make comparison like that, it can be quite damaging. Of course, now, we have to see the effect. Sometimes, in some cases, comparison can be stimulating. Because, say, if both of them have similar talents, and then that person is working as a talent plus temperament leads to achievement. So, that is, both of them have more or less similar talents, But then that person has a better temperament. That person has more commitment. Then when there is comparison, you know, you also work harder. It's possible. And then that comparison might bring out the better within a person. But even then, it is better to focus not on that person as a reference point. It is better to focus on one's own potential as a reference point. This is the critical thing in coaching. A coach, by the very nature of coaching, has to be aware of the coached or the player's faults. You know, that, say, you know, this batsman, he shuffles too much while batting. And the ball comes, he has to be steady. Or this person, batsman, you know, he doesn't keep his eyes focused or whatever. Now the coach is aware of the deficiencies of the player. But if the coach tells too much the deficiencies of the player only, no, you know, you're not doing this right, you're not doing this right, you're not doing this right, you're not doing this right. Then the player will think, what am I doing right? You know? Maybe I shouldn't be playing only. And the player gives a play. So for a coach, there has to be a very delicate balance. That they have to tell the player what they're doing wrong, but the player should not feel discouraged. So, correcting people without discouraging them, it's a great art. And not just a great art, it's a vital art. When we correct others, if that correction damages their confidence, then we often end up doing a disservice to them because they become demoralized. And when they are demoralized, they just don't do anything. So they don't do anything because they feel I can't do anything. They feel I can't do anything, then there is total disheartenment. So it's, you know, for a person to improve, there are basically three things required. One is the knowledge that I need to improve. Second is the process of how to improve. And the third is the will to improve. Three things: the knowledge, the process, and the will. In general, in anything that we are doing, if we want to become better. So if somebody is very, as is critical, always finding faults, then what happens is, we may think I am doing it for their good. That actually, you know, I want this person to become better. But when we keep finding faults with others, our desire may be to make them better. But we make them bitter instead. Bitter means that they feel bitter about us, or they feel bitter about the work itself. I can't do this. Every time I start studying, every time I start doing this thing, and I'm told this is wrong. Maybe I should not do this only. Even if they do it, actually their spirit has been wounded. Their spirit has practically been killed. And then they will just drag their feet, somehow try to move onwards. So when a coach is coaching a player, what do? They definitely want to improve the player. And improving, to some extent, requires telling what they are doing wrong. But while doing this, it is vital that the player be reassured of their basic caliber. So you're a good player and you can do this, this, this. You can do this also, do it. Now this you are doing good, this you are doing good, this you are doing good. And you can do this also, do it. So when there is interaction, if we interact with others only to point faults, hey, you did not keep your room clean. You kept your shoes here. You did not do your homework. You did not do this. You did not do that. If that is the only basis of our interaction, then the whole relationship becomes bitter. Although our intention may be to make them bitter, but it becomes bitter. So the coach has to affirm the basic worth of the player. The coach has to, actually, the coach's greatest job, you know, a coach may think my job is you are not bowling properly, I'll tell you how to bowl properly. But that is not the coach's only job. The coach's job is not only to give the knowledge or the process. The coach's job is also to give the will, to inspire the will. And the good, best coaches, the most important, if you look at the relationship between coaches and players, what the players remember the most. They may, hey, this coach told me, you know, you're batting like this, but maybe you can turn a little bit square. Those are things, techniques they remember. But what they remember the most is, when they were down, how the coach encouraged them. When they were depressed, when they were facing criticism, how the coach encouraged them. So those are the words that the players remember the most. And that's what they are grateful for. The same way, the specific points we tell for correcting our children, for helping them to become better, they are important. But more important than that is, what is the overall tenor of our relationship? Now, if the main memory that the child has is, you know, I was always made to feel that I didn't live up to my parents' expectations. If that is what the child remembers about the parents, they had so many expectations that I couldn't live up to their expectations, then that is not a very healthy tenor for the relationship. Now, the idea is that the child should remember, my parents loved me, my parents encouraged me, my parents guided me, and they also helped me to do this, helped me to do that, helped me to do that. All that is there. In the Bhagavad Gita, we could consider that also like a coach-student model. So Arjuna, at the start, if you see in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna doesn't have to tell Arjuna anything about how to fight archery, how specifically to play. It's like, say, there's a World Cup finals. And before that, the coach gives a talk to the players. Now, at that time, if the team has already come to the World Cup finals, the team basically knows how to bat, how to ball. At that time, when the coach gives a talk before the players go out to play, at that time, the coach may not tell, hey, you know, when you bowl like this, you bowl like this. When you bat like this. The coach will basically inspire them. This is the most important match of your life. Millions of people will be watching. Just do your best. You will remember these next 6 hours throughout your life. And if you do well here, then whatever else you do in your life, that moment, this is what is going to be your greatest memory. Go out and perform. Basically, just inspire them. So like that, if we see what Krishna does to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, it's a war, and Arjuna is fighting the biggest war of his life. The war for which he has been preparing throughout his life. And while he is preparing like this, while he is just on the verge of fighting that war, Arjuna loses his nerve. And when the Bhagavad Gita is spoken, it is just before a war is about to start. Now, to understand how dramatic the setting of the Bhagavad Gita is, just compare, there's a World Cup final. And there are thousands and thousands of spectators who are there in the stadium. There are millions who are watching on television. And the toss has been done. The batsmen have come. The bowlers are on the field. The bowler is about to be in the run-up. About to start off the run, come and ball. And at that time, the batsman is called the non-striker. And the batsman and the non-striker start talking. And they talk. And they keep talking. And they keep talking. Not just for 30 seconds, not just for 1 minute, for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 1 hour they keep talking. Now, everybody will become restless. What is this? It's a World Cup final. Everybody is waiting for the match to be played. Why are they talking like this? Now, sometimes, some players do gamesmanship. Gamesmanship is what? You know, if one player, one batsman is very much in form, then what the bowler will try to do, the bowling captain might try to do, just slow down the game. Now slow down the game and try to break the rhythm of the player. So basically, when we know that we are not doing so well and the other team is doing well, then we may try to delay the playing so that the tide may change. There's in tennis, there's one player who's accused of doing that all the time. So that it always happens. But if we know that this batsman is a non-striker, they are not that kind of gamesman. They are not doing any trick to delay the process. They are very good, honest, talented, principled players. Then you will wonder, if they are talking on the pitch while the World Cup final is about to start, that means there must be something really serious they are talking about. Something really serious. So actually the Bhagavad Gita setting is like that. You know, the biggest wars is going to take place. You know, the conches have been blown. Everybody has taken out their bow and arrow and about to fight. At that time, Arjuna tells Krishna, Senayor Ubhayor Madhye Ratham Sthapayame Achyuta. Please take my chariot in between the two armies. And then Arjuna becomes overwhelmed. How can I fight? Nayotseti Govindam Upva Tushnim Babuvaha. He says, I cannot fight Govinda. And then they start talking. They keep talking. So just by the setting of the Gita, we understand that this is something extraordinary. There must be something desperately urgent because of which they are talking like this. Now if the opposing team captain is a very confrontational type of person, you go to the camp, umpire and complain, why are they talking so much? But if the opposing team captain is also a sportsmanly person, so you know, if they're talking like this, it must be something serious. Let them talk. So Bhishma is like that sportsmanly opposing captain. Now when he sees Krishna and Arjuna talking, he raises his hand, tells his warriors, stop. And they all lower their bow and wait. And Krishna and Arjuna, their discussion goes on. So the point I was making here is, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna does not tell Arjuna anything about how to fight the war in terms of, you know, which astra to use, how to defeat which enemy, what phalanx to form, what viewer to form. He does not talk anything about war strategies at all. He does not talk anything about the specifics of archery at all. What is Krishna doing? Krishna is actually simply inspiring Arjuna. He is restoring Arjuna's morale. He is boosting Arjuna's determination, his willpower. At the start of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna puts aside his bow, discouraged. Visrujya sasharam chapam shokasam vigna manasaha. In 1.46, it is described that he puts aside his bow. I can't fight. He's discouraged. Shokasam vigna. He's overwhelmed with grief. By the end of the Bhagavad Gita, this is 1.46, the end of the first chapter. If you go to 18.78, last verse of the last chapter, what happens? Yatra Yogeshwara Krishna Yatra Partho Dhanurdharaha. So here described Partha, who is Arjuna, who is Dhanurdharaha, who is. This is not just an attribute of Arjuna. This is actually describing the action of Krishna, Arjuna, at that time, that he has picked up his bow and he's ready to fight. So Arjuna's Gandiva bow represents our determination. When we face problems in life, you know, we lose our determination, we lose our confidence, we lose our willpower. And we put aside our bow. I can't do this. Sometimes, you know, a student may find some subject very difficult to study. Say, no, I just can't do this. I give up. So, visrujya sasharam chapam shokasam vigna manas, I can't do it. I can't do it. So what happens at that time? Krishna's role as a coach is what? It is not to tell Arjuna what is wrong or how to set it right. It is just to get him, primarily it is to inspire him. And that's what Krishna does to Arjuna. So in our life also, we'll see that actually sometimes we may get discouraged, or those whom we are trying to train, they may get discouraged. So the Gita's message is not simply to correct them. Ah, you're wrong. Actually, the most important help that we can offer people is not correcting the specific wrongs that they are doing. It is actually inspiring the right spirit within them. There was a British author who said that I have never let my schooling interfere with my education.
I have never let my schooling interfere with my education. Normally, we think schooling is the education. You go to school to get educated. But quite often, when the schooling is very standardized, everybody has to study this subject, that subject, that subject, then the child's own talents may not be developed. So, child has talents, those talents have to be separately nourished. So, I don't let my schooling interfere with my education. So, the point of schooling is not just to tell people this is to be done, that is to be done, that is to be done. And then these facts have to be memorized. That's okay. But it is to bring out the inner spirit within them. So, if that spirit is awakened, then they will themselves be motivated and they will achieve wonderful things. So, we see in the middle of the Bhagavad Gita, around the sixth chapter, Arjuna starts saying, oh, this is very difficult. Krishna talks about controlling the mind. And Arjuna says, Yoyam yogastvaya proktah samyena madhusudana etasyaham na pashyami chanchalatva sitim sthiram. He says, oh, Krishna, what process you have told me? It seems impossible for me. Chanchalam hi manah Krishna pramathi balavadrudham tasyaham nigraham manye vayorivasu dushkaram. So the mind is restless, it is turbulent, it is obstinate. Controlling it is as difficult as controlling a raging wind. Krishna says, I can't do it. 33 and 34, this is what Arjuna tells Krishna. Now what does Krishna tell Arjuna in response? Krishna doesn't say, you are insincere. What is Krishna's response? His point 35 is, Asamshayam mahabaho manodurnigraham chalam abhyasena tu kaunteya vairagena chigruhyate. Asamshayam mahabaho. Oh yeah, undoubtedly. Manodurnigraham chalam. It's very difficult to control the mind. So, you know, before people will understand us, they have to feel that we have understood them. Before people will understand what we are saying, they have to feel that we have understood them. Suppose we go to a doctor. And the doctor immediately says, okay, you have to take this medicine, take this medicine, take this medicine. You have to take this injection and we'll do the surgery. I did not tell you my symptoms only. How are you prescribing this? Patient needs to be the doctor may say, no, I can see these symptoms. I can see this, your skin has become discolored, your pigments have become discolored, whatever. The doctor may be able to see immediately also. But still, the doctor has to make sure that the patient feels that I have heard. If somebody prescribes without diagnosing, or sometimes somebody prescribes after diagnosing, but the patient feels that they are not diagnosed beautifully, then the patient will not take the treatment wholeheartedly. So what Krishna does to Arjuna is, he empathizes with Arjuna. He says, yes, I understand. This is difficult. It is difficult, I agree. But after acknowledging the difficulty, he says, yes, it's difficult, but it's possible. Abhyasena tu kaunteya vairagena cha gruhyate. If you see these two points, abhyas and vairagya, this is not a new point. Essentially, this is what Krishna has told earlier also. This abhyasa means consistent practice. Vairagya means detachment. So, what Krishna has told from 6.10 to 6.32, and Arjuna has objected in 6.33-34. Krishna in 6.35 repeats more or less the same thing. But Krishna empathizes with Arjuna. And that empathy is what works over there. Yes. Arjuna feels understood. So something may be very easy for us, but something may be difficult for others. Now, if Krishna starts speaking the whole Bhagavad Gita from his perspective is the God's perspective. If he speaks from that perspective, now for God, he's omnipotent. For him, nothing is very difficult. For him, he can easily control the mind. Krishna may tell Arjuna, you know, you are insincere. You just control the mind. What is the difficulty? No. Actually, it's not easy. For Arjuna, it is not easy, and Krishna has to see from Arjuna's perspective. So, the coach may have been a champion bowler who is retired now and has become a coach. Now, somebody might be just a rookie bowler, just started bowling. Now, the champion bowler starts seeing from the standards of the rookie bowler. Now, the coach starts from the looking from the
perspective champion bowler, you know, you should just bowl on the middle stump. Why are you straying in your line like this? Well, that bowler who is just practicing may not have that much control over line and length. It will come by practice. But in the, so, you know, when it is, sometimes we say, I'll put that person in their place. And you know, this person is being arrogant, argumentative. I'll put them in their place. Actually, in relationships, more important than putting others in this, their place is putting ourselves in their place. Don't put others in their place. Put yourself in their place. That means if this coach thinks, okay, I have been practicing bowling for 30, 40 years now. This young man, you know, has been practicing for 5 years or 10 years. And he's not been practicing on such pitches with such balls. Put yourself in their place. Then we will be able to give guidance which helps that person. Otherwise, we may say, I did my part. No, I gave advice, but they didn't take the advice. That's their problem. No, a coach means it's not just give advice, but give advice in a way that the player feels inspired to apply it. So, that is all. A large part of training is to inspire the trainee to keep training. So, training is not just about the specifics out of train. Training also involves inspiring the trainee to keep training. And that is what Krishna is doing to Arjuna. Krishna is doing, ask Arjuna. Yes, I understand it is difficult, but it is possible. So, when we are trying to practice, when we are trying to do anything in our life. So, I did not talk about talents. Specific talents that children have, and those have to be tapped and developed. Now, suppose you know we have a phone, and then one day we suddenly discover that phone has some feature which we didn't know. No, maybe that phone we didn't know that the phone had a sound recorder in it, and we used to carry another sound recorder to record things. And suddenly one day, hey, this is a recorder. Oh, so wonderful. You know, in some device which we have, if we suddenly discover that it has some feature to it which you didn't know, it's a delightful discovery. Now think about it, if you sometimes you are rummaging through your phone home and suddenly find you have a phone yourself over there, a new phone. You didn't know it was there. How did it come? I had this phone, I didn't know only. Maybe somebody gave it a gift in some pack and we forgot to open that gift only. It was there over there. So if we just discover something new in what we have, it's so wonderful. So actually, for us, when we are practicing, when we get introduced to spirituality, when we start practicing bhakti, or when we hear the Bhagavad Gita's wisdom, we understand actually there is a side to me that is eternal. I was thinking that I'm living in this world and there's some accident happened, old age happened, and I die, it's over. When I come to know, there's a whole side of me that is eternal. It's such an exciting and empowering discovery. Ashcharyavat pashyati kashchidena. Those people who can actually see the soul, this is amazing. Oh, amazing. You know, there's a whole side to me that is eternal. So, it's like in cricket. Somebody is included in the team as a bowler. But then the team is in a crunch. All the top order has collapsed. Even the middle order has collapsed. That batsman goes in as a tail-ender and that batsman starts his batting brilliantly, you know, fours and sixes, and number 10 batsman scores a century and all the previous 9 players have not even crossed double figures. Wow, you know, we didn't know we had such a good batsman in our team. Isn't it? So like that, when we discover some hidden ability in someone, when some circumstances brings it out, it's a great discovery. So, when we start practicing bhakti, if we understand the philosophy of bhakti, it's a discovery for us. And it's exciting. But, when we try to infuse bhakti in our children, it is not a discovery for them. It is just something which they got with their upbringing. So, for them, it's just a part of life. Yes, you know, I used to go to temple, I used to participate in kirtans, I used to have katha. And yeah, it's just the way we grew up. And then when the children come to teenage, at that time, for them, For us, no, spirituality was a discovery. But for them, materialistic life is a discovery. Oh, you know, you can do this also. You can do this. I didn't do this in my childhood, you know. So at that time, their energy starts going into exploring what they feel they did not get. Now, we are giving them what most children are not getting. But because that is what they have got since their childhood, they feel, yeah, this is, I didn't get that. I want that. They want to explore the things which they did not get. And at that can be a very challenging time for their parents. Especially when somebody comes into adolescence. I was just in Bahrain, I spoke to the youth over there. I talked about how navigating the emotional and social turbulence of adolescence. That's the talk I gave on the topic. So basically, adolescence is an extremely turbulent period. Now, parents may feel, you know, my sweet little boy, where did it disappear? You know, this angry, arrogant youth, who's coming in my place? You know, it's like sometimes in some movies, you know, there's a double role where, you know, there are two people who look alike, but one is the hero, the other is the villain. And then, you know, the hero is suddenly replaced by the villain. People start saying, hey, I'm such a nice person, why is he become like this? So like that, when children come into adolescence, seem to change completely. You know, my sweet little boy, my sweet little girl, what happened to them? Actually, nothing has happened to them. Just they are going through some changes. So adolescence is a time when everyone wants to explore. And at that time, it's a very testing time both for the children and the parents. Because what happens in childhood, one's identity is inextricably associated with one's parents. Now, who are you? When children ask their name, the name is fine, but they also ask, now, whose child are you? Who are your parents? The child's identity is associated with the parents. Now, when they grow adults, for example, if somebody meets you, they're not going to ask who your parents are. That's not the first thing they're going to ask. Ask who you are. Okay, what is your profession? What do? Where do you stay? So, in adulthood, we have our own identity. In childhood, our identity is inextricably associated with our parents. But in adolescence, it's neither here nor there. In adolescence, the children have not evolved their own identity. At the same time, they don't want to be stuck in their identity as son and daughter of so-and-so. They want to have their own identity. And that desire for their own identity often makes them explore things. Do things which their parents do not want them to do. So at that time, we need to be understanding. If we just restrict them, no, you should not do this, should not do this, should not do this. They may not do at that time, but the rebellion is building up within them. And the moment they get independence, maybe it'll be physical independence, they go somewhere for college, or financial independence, they start earning, then all that rebellion will come out. So I'll conclude with this point that ultimately we have to know that we can't control other people. We can only inspire them. Even at Krishna himself, he is God. But at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, what does he do? He tells Arjuna, Vimrishaitada Sheshena Yathechasitatha Kuru. Deliberate deeply and then decide what you want to do. When Krishna doesn't control Arjuna, gives him intelligence, gives him knowledge, and then he says, now you decide what you want to do. So same way, ultimately, our children are souls. We are a soul, they are a soul, and they have their relationship with Krishna, we have our relationship with Krishna. And they are on their own journey of spiritual evolution. They will, Krishna is in their hearts also. And they also have impressions of Krishna Bhakti. But how fast they will move, what path they will choose for moving towards Krishna, that is something which we can't control. So, accepting that, you know, I won't be always able to control my children. That itself requires detachment. But that also brings a perspective to the relationship. So it's not that if my children don't become devotees, it is my failure. We shouldn't, as I said, in the material life also, you know, if my child doesn't become a doctor, parents are doctor, they feel that, oh, my life is a failure. My child didn't become a doctor.
So just like we might project in material life and put some expectation on the children, like that we may do the same thing in spiritual life. That's not necessary. One thing about bhakti is that whereas some child may just not have the inclination, the intelligence to be a doctor, they just can't become. But in bhakti, in spiritual direction, in spiritual side of life, everybody is a soul. Every soul has the potential to love Krishna. So in that sense, you know, they, if in the childhood we have given them impressions of Krishna bhakti, those impressions are there in their hearts. And those impressions will eventually manifest. So in this case, you know, in coaching, in spiritual coaching, actually our job is easier. Because, as I said, we can't create talent. We can only spot talent and develop talent. So as far as the talent in terms of the potential for spiritual growth is concerned, everybody has that. But although everybody has that, everybody may not move at the same pace towards Krishna. So what the mood of the Bhagavad Gita is, if you see, Krishna says, "Ye tha maam prapadyante taam tathai bhajamyaham." From however you approach me, I reciprocate accordingly. Krishna uses so many levels. If you look at the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, always think of me. That's 12.8. So if you can't always think of me, then try to do sadhana bhakti and fix your mind on me for some time. If you can't do that, then work for me. If you can't do that, then at least, you know, work in a mood of detachment and give your fruits to some good cause. So Krishna has multiple alternatives. Whatever level you are, you start from there. So Krishna's mood is at your pace, from your place, join the race. It is what? At your pace. Okay. You cannot practice bhakti wholeheartedly right now. Okay. At your pace. From your place. Okay. You are right now not there for practicing bhakti at a very high level. Okay. You are at this level. Take one step forward. So join the race. We are all in a race against time. Now we are all moving towards death. We all have finite amount of time. So we can't do everything that we may want to do. So Krishna says, at your pace, from your place, join the race. Whatever steps you can take, you take and move onwards. So same way, what we need to do is, with respect to our children, we give them devotional impressions in their childhood. Give them the opportunity to practice bhakti. See, for the door to change can be opened only from inside. The door to change is like sometimes security doors are such that you can put a key, but if it latches from inside, you just can't open it. So like that, the door to personal change, it can be opened only from inside. So ultimately, that person has to be inspired. And how can we inspire others? We can do basically three things for them. We can give knowledge, we can provide facilities, and we can set example. Earlier, same thing I said. What can we do for others? You give knowledge. You do this, and this is the result of this doing this. And if you want to do this, how can you do it? You provide a facility for doing it. And set an example. Set an example means give inspiration. And after that, it's between them and Krishna. And they will take it up in due course. So if you give opportunity, they will take it up. At their time, they will take up enthusiastically. In Pune, there was one devotee couple's son. The daughter was a wonderful devotee. This devotee couple was also a very dedicated devotee. But their son, when he came to adolescence, he had this exploring. Do this, do that, do that. But the parents were mature. They gave him good counsel, but they let him do it. And, you know, one time, this was many years, 10, 15 years ago, one time Michael Jackson came to India. So, you know, I want to go and see his show. So he went for that show. You know, he had to fight through traffic, spend a lot of money. And finally got to that show. And then he was in that show, and suddenly as he was hearing it, suddenly it struck him. This is just noise. Even the simple kirtan in a temple was so much sweeter. What am I doing here? What happened? Actually, he did not do anything on that particular day, but all the kirtan that he had attended in his childhood, they're all as an impression there. And here, he went through so much trouble to get this. And suddenly it struck me, hey, this is just noise. Like there is a story of Bilwa Mangal Thakur who went to Chintamani. She told him, she was a society woman, she told him, if you had only worked so hard for Krishna, you would have been liberated by him. Ah, yeah, that's right. So nobody told him, But Krishna told him from within the heart, this is just noise. Why are you wasting your time doing this? And then, after that, he started coming back. And now, he's not just a serious devotee. He's actually a devotee preacher. One of the leading preachers in the younger generation. So, he explored, but he came back. Because the impressions were there. So, we give impressions devotionally. We provide facility. We give knowledge, set an example. And after that, leave it between them and Krishna. If we make it an ego issue, if somebody is doing something wrong, we say, you know, you are doing wrong. And one day you will come crawling back on your knees and admit that you were wrong and I was right. If you make it like that, even if they realize they are wrong, they will not come back. Because what happened? It has become an ego issue. So what we should do is, we open the door and show the way. But if they don't come in, it's all right, they slam the door in their face. No, keep the door open. Keep the door open. When they want, they will come in. And that's what Krishna does for Arjuna. And that is what we need to do. Provide facilities, keep the door open, invite them. But then let them come at their pace. And we will see in due course of time, the impressions that we are given in childhood, they will act. They've got that higher taste of Krishna consciousness. And that will bring them to Krishna sooner or later. So I'll summarize. I spoke about now what cricket can teach us about life. I primarily focus on coaching. In that, I spoke about how coaches cannot create talent. They can only spot and develop talent. So a coach cannot make a bowler into a batsman. And similarly, we, if we try to project our unfulfilled expectations on our children and try to make them into something which they are not, now that will cause a lot of friction and frustration. Instead, if we focus on trying to understand who they are and to help them develop, then the relationship will be much more harmonious. We talked about the mother and father fighting over whether the child should be a doctor or a son. The child is not even born. So like that, we project our expectations too much sometimes. So the Bhagavad Gita tells us that different people have different talents, different interests, and they have to be engaged accordingly. See, only when we have interest in something, then we can perceive the problem as a challenge. Otherwise, we'll see the problem as a burden. So, we all have to bear burdens in life sometimes, but if life itself is a burden, it will become unbearable. So, if you force people to do something which they're just not shaped to do, then they will be miserable, and their inability to do it will make us miserable. So there is talent plus temperament that will lead to achievement. So people, as parents, our primary goal is to help them develop their temperament. Talent is there and talent can be shaped, but we can't create talent. So we have to see children in their own terms, not in terms of our expectations and our dreams. And whatever talent they have, we help them to develop. So a coach's job has three things, you know, telling the student what is wrong, and then giving the knowledge, giving the process, and then giving the inspiration. If the coach simply tells, this is wrong, and this is the process, but doesn't give inspiration, and too much negative feedback may just dishearten the player may stop playing. So similarly, if our interaction with children is only telling them, no, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, then our desire may be to make them better, but actually we make them bitter. So there is a primary platform of acceptance, of affection, of love, of encouragement. And within that, there can be constructive feedback that is given. And then discussed about how the whole purpose of the Bhagavad Gita was to elevate Arjuna. Now, he had lost his morale, and the Bhagavad Gita helped Arjuna to gain his morale. He put aside his Gandhi Babu, he lifted up the Gandhi Babu. Similarly, in life, there will be times when those whom we are connected with, those whom we are responsible, they lose morale. So at that time, we have to guide them in such a way that they feel affirmed, they feel encouraged. And how does Krishna do that? Especially when Arjuna said that mind is very difficult to control. Krishna did not put Arjuna in his place. Krishna put himself in his place. Don't put others in their place. Put yourself in their place. See things from their perspective. And then we will be able to give guidance that makes sense. So a champion bowler cannot chastise a new bowler for not having the level of control that a champion bowler has. So if people are to understand us, they need to feel that we have understood them. The doctor who prescribes without hearing the patient will not get the cooperation of the patient, even if the diagnosis is right. So if people don't feel that we have understood their problems, then even if what we are giving is good for them and they can do it, still they will not do it. So that communication has to be two-way, empathic, understanding has to be there. And then the last point I discussed about that, whereas whereas children may have certain talents or may not have certain talents, and we can't create talents, but spirituality, the inclination for loving Krishna, the potential for loving Krishna is there in everyone. However, not everyone may take it up, because for us, our spirituality was a discovery. We were living more or less materialistic lives, and then discovering some new feature in our phone or discovering a new phone itself, our spirituality was a discovery for us. But for our children, especially those who have been brought up in a devotional environment, for them, material life is a discovery. Spiritual life is something which they already got. So when they start exploring that, it can be very tumult, distressing phase. So in adolescence, when that whole the person seems to change, what has changed is actually the way they think, the way they feel. They're going through a new phase where they're discovering their identity. And that time they may assert their independence by going against their parents. So at this stage, we need to know that we can't control anyone's free will. We can give knowledge, we can provide facility, we can set example. And then it's up to them to make the choice. Just as Krishna leaves it to Arjuna, yathech sitha kuru. And because we have given the devotional impressions in childhood, because every soul has the potential to love Krishna, sooner or later, that impressions will attract them back. And that's just like, this is just noise that child, that devotee son realized. And then started practicing bhakti once again. So it is between them and Krishna. And we have done our part. We shouldn't take their not practicing bhakti as our personal failure. We have done our part, and we keep the door open for them. Not that we make it an ego issue and make them feel bad about not practicing bhakti. Keep the door open, and in due course, they will march forwards. And they will also attain Krishna's lotus feet. So thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Yes. Does anyone have any questions?
Thank you so much for your wonderful class. Actually, I have two questions, so should I ask together?
Okay, go ahead. First, one question at least.
First, as you might have seen, most of the people in this crowd is one for these children only. So that your whole session was related to them. Most of them are players also, and they are very good in studies also. So my question was, now they are in, most of them are devoted children. That last phase of your lecture was that they will be discovering. So how can we miss or else how chanting will help them in their spiritual life as well as in their studies? Yes, how spiritual life will help them in their both the balance? So could you please?
So how can chanting or our spiritual life help one in both aspects of one's life, spiritual and material? So of course, chanting, spiritual life is all about developing a relationship with Krishna, and chanting is calling out to Krishna. So it definitely helps us develop our relationship with Krishna. Now as far as our material life is concerned, we often, students, a big challenge is concentration. To study, you have to concentrate. And we often analyze our schedule according to the activities that we do. Okay, in the morning I have to do this, afternoon I have to do this, evening I have to do this. But actually, along with activities, what takes our time is also thoughts, is also desires. Sometimes we go to a class, we sit in front of the class, but just before going to the class, say somebody insulted us, somebody snubbed us, or somebody spoke badly about us. And then we are in the class, and 1 hour you're sitting in front of the teacher, looking at the blackboard. But the mind is revenge fantasy. I'm going to get back at that person. But we don't hear anything. So what happened? One thought came in and took away all that time. So if we can regulate and manage our thoughts, we can actually become much more effective. So what our chanting does is, it brings order to our inner world. It regulates our thought energy. So concentration is something which is like a muscle. Now when you lift weights, by that, every time we lift weights, our muscles are becoming stronger by the lifting of the weights. And then when we have to lift heavy weights, we'll be better prepared to lift it. So we can see chanting as an inner bodybuilding exercise. The mind has a tendency to be distracted, but when I try to fix the mind on the holy name, it's like I'm trying to lift an inner weight. It's difficult. But if I do it, later on, throughout the day, when the mind gets distracted and I want to focus on something, I'll have greater muscles. Bring the mind back and focus. So concentration, enhanced capacity for concentration is something which will definitely be developed by the process of chanting. And that way, although chanting may seem to be like one more thing I have to do, I have so many things to do, there's one more thing to do. But actually, chanting won't take our time. Chanting will help us get back the time which we lose unwittingly because of stray thoughts, random desires. We'll get it back. In that way, time we invest in chanting will make us capable of more effectively using whatever time we are investing in other activities. Okay? Thank you. Okay, quickly, one question. Last question.
Right now, we are living in a material life, right? So, do you think pursuing like the talent that we have, which is material, will help us in spiritual life, or is it just something that we invest and waste our time?
Okay. So, if we have a material talent and pursuing that talent, will that help us in our spiritual life, or is it something material? Actually, you know, we can't very rigidly separate material and spiritual. Ultimately, the material also comes from Krishna. So our material talents are also gifts from Krishna. So some material talents may be directly usable in Krishna's service. Say if I can sing, I can play musical instruments, I can speak. The talents I can use in Krishna's service. There may be other talents which may not be directly usable in Krishna's service. But whatever talents we have, they are gifts from Krishna. So what we are is God's gift to us. What we become is our gift to God. So if we have some talents, we can definitely try to develop them. Now we have to see how I'll be able to balance the development of my talents with my practice of spiritual life. So all talents, if we develop them, we're actually serving God. Now that may not be directly devotional service. Even the talent might not be directly usable in devotional service. But if we have talent, we develop that, we make a positive contribution in society. And people say, oh, this talented person is so talented and this person also a devotee. And they're like, oh, that means bhakti is nice. Bhakti doesn't mean you renounce everything. You can be talented, you can do things in life, and you can also be a devotee. So that gives a positive impression to people. So in that sense, developing our talents, we can see it as a service to Krishna. Not as a direct service, but say indirectly a service to Krishna. But to have that service attitude, we also need to be practicing bhakti directly. We need to come to temple, associate with devotees regularly. Only when we are doing that, then our service attitude will be maintained. Otherwise, what will happen is, in trying to develop that talent, we will get so caught and consumed that we will not be able to stay connected with Krishna. So developing the talent, so like we basically allocate some time. This is my time for my devotional activities and this is my time for my other activities. So when we are doing other activities, our professional activities, our exploring our talents, we don't have to always be thinking, this is material, I should not do this. No. This is also service to Krishna. While we are doing something, do it wholeheartedly. But while doing it wholeheartedly, we shouldn't get so carried away that we say, I don't have time for my spiritual life. So whatever we do it wholeheartedly and we give due time for our spiritual life and then give due attention to our other activities also when we are doing them. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yes?
Prabhu, now sometimes we told that talents should be discovered. Most of the time we can't find it on our own. But without the right association, we can't find. So suppose we're born in a family where like most of them cannot discover talents or they don't send us to different places, how can we find a talent?
Okay. So if we are in a family where we are not allowed to explore much and we can't discover our talents, what should we do? See, we have to know that our relationship is with Krishna. We have relationship with parents, with our social circle, but ultimately it is also with Krishna. So, you know, if Krishna has given us talents, He will give us the facility to discover and develop the talents also. So we sometimes are put in circumstances where we may not be able to do certain things. But that doesn't mean that those circumstances are necessary, are those who are people around us, they are like, they are suppressing our talents or they are against us. Now, we all are sometimes constrained by our circumstances. We accept that. But if we feel that we have certain talents or we will be able to explore something, we, rather than resenting the situation we are in, we can focus more on praying to Krishna. We pray to Krishna, Krishna will guide us in a situation where, I think one of the famous batsmen of England is actually a football player. And he had gone for a football match and the football match got cancelled. And at that time, a cricket match was also going on in the next ground. And one cricket player got injured. So they told, why don't you play over here? He said, I never played cricket. I'm not interested in cricket. He said, no, just play. And he came into a bat and he hit a century. His first time he played cricket. And then he realized that people don't, you're so talented in cricket. And you're a mediocre football player. You know, you play this. And he's now become a international cricket player. So, you know, his parents didn't plan it that way. I don't remember the name. I think, does anyone else know? Anyway, I have it somewhere. I read it long ago. So the point is that, you know, there is what is called as serendipity. Serendipity means accidental, discovery of something good by accident. So we should know that it is that we are not always products of our circumstances. Even if certain circumstances restrict us, if we pray to Krishna, Krishna will guide us to rise above the circumstances. See, it's not that just by exploration there is discovery. Because, you know, that way there are hundreds of things to explore in life. We just spend our life exploring only. But if there's something to be discovered, Krishna will guide us to discover that. Okay?
So many times our mentality is like that, by the atmosphere, that we don't want to explore things, so, you know, associated with Krishna. Because in this case, suppose the family is not associated with Krishna consciousness, and the atmosphere is not able to learn, your mentality will change. That I don't want to learn, I don't want to explore.
Okay. Yeah, so sometimes if we are in a family where there's not much encouragement to explore, then we will lose the zeal to explore also. Yes, it's like, I'd say that, like digging for gold. Now I can dig at this place or I can dig over there. Now, where gold is for sure, I don't know. But if I just keep digging at the surface at 10 places, one thing is sure, I'll never get gold. Because gold is hardly ever at the surface. I have to dig deep. So what happens is, we have to do what we are doing wholeheartedly. So there are, in whatever situation we are in, there is certain things which are in our control. And certain things are not in our control. Now just focusing on the things which are not in our control, that makes us feel powerless. That makes us feel frustrated. But if we do what we can do and do it well, ultimately Krishna will guide us. So even if we feel that we are not encouraged to explore, and because of that we may lose the learning ability, what we can see otherwise is, okay, in this situation, what can I learn? In this situation, I'm not able to explore new, but in this situation, what is it I can learn more? So sometimes, you know, sometimes we learn more by exploring, and sometimes we learn also by adapting. Because, you know, life will not always go according to the way we plan. So learn, if somebody is a very adaptable player, as in cricket, some player, they may like to open the batting, but they told you come at number 4, come at number 6. Now if a player adapts and learns to bat wherever they are, bats accordingly, then that player becomes a much more invaluable asset for the team. Eventually, with the opportunity, that player will be allowed to open. But the player becomes a versatile player. So our growth is not just about exploring and learning new things. It is also about learning how better to adapt to the situation we are in. That is also a part of growth. So if we are in a situation which is restrictive, then we can think that this is an opportunity to learn adaptability and to learn to grow in this situation. Okay. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Shri Prabhupada ki. Hare Krishna. 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 Hare Krishna